Great, thank you for having me. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to talk to you about data for the people. Tomorrow, I'll do a workshop, People for the Data, which focuses on the opposite. It focuses what skills do we need to have in order to survive as individuals? What are these mindset questions we have in companies? But today, data for the people. So the first question here is, who is the people? Who am we? Who are we? Who am I? So the question of identity is what I start with. My second part of my talk, I will talk about the value of data. In the third part of my talk, I will talk about what rules and what rights we should have as consumers, as citizens. And the last part of my talk, I will draw some conclusions what companies should do about the data. So four parts: identity and trust, two, value of data, three is rights for consumers, and four is rules for companies. So yesterday, I learned that there were 86,332 people after the Pope became registered here in Estonia. I last night spent 100 euros and I am the newest registrant for the identity card here. So that happened because Martin was so convincing at lunch yesterday that that's what I did in the middle of the night. And here is what they told me, that I just have to wait for my thing to come. But I'm already welcome in this digital nation. That was easy. Let's compare this to 1987. This is not a file I created. That's the copy of the cover of my Stasi file, the East German secret police created for me. How, you might wonder, did I learn about that? Well, after my dad died, he spent several years in prison in East Germany because they thought he was an American spy. After my dad died, I actually wrote to the government whether I could get a copy of his Stasi file. And I got a letter back, and they said, well, sorry, we had to delete his Stasi file to protect the innocent informants. But since you asked, we're wondering whether you might be interested in a copy of your Stasi file. And that was, I was in high school at that time. I was just an undergraduate when they started that. So that was a world where creating data was very expensive. And by some accounts, 10% of all the people who worked in East Germany were in some way or form actually informants to the Stasi. So now I actually was slightly worried when Martin yesterday told me that they will do a security check for me. Because of my birthday is November 10, and in 2016, I spent my birthday party in Moscow. And that was, by the way, the day after the Trump election. I learned about it as I was on my way to the Kremlin to meet with this gentleman. And he actually invited me to teach him about AI. And I, of course, had no idea about anything potentially interesting about the US election. When he congratulated me to being the first US citizen to the outcome of the election, I had no idea. And then halfway through the meeting, the former economics minister left. He took a phone call. Hermann Graf took a phone call in the meeting. I thought, wow, that is pretty rad. I mean, I wouldn't take a phone call, you know, as it was, if when I'm meeting with Putin. So when he came back, I said, well, you know, what was that phone call about? Being curious. And they said, we had an attack. I was thinking, attack, computer attack. Oh, computer attack. And I, no, I mean, computer attacks come from Russia or they come from China. So I was in Russia, so I said, oh, that must have come from China. And he said, maybe not. Think again. So that was retaliation of the Americans the day after the election of attacking the Russian networks. But what I really want to talk about here is, what can we trust? So, I mean, I'm not that good at Photoshop, but maybe I just Photoshop this. So what we would do is, we look at Google. And now if Google brings up that picture, then we trust it, right? We trust Google, don't we? So it's an interesting question about what to trust and what not to trust. Since I already shared my Photoshop skills with you, here's another picture. And that is my name, Andreas Weigand. And data for the people that is, or data for the something, you know, is, you know, the title of this talk here. And Angela Merkel said, let's take a selfie, but now do I get to keep the copy? And I said, absolutely, yes, the copy is yours. But how do we know that that is true? Well, I am actually verified on Twitter. So this blue check mark means that Twitter verified me. So I think this must make it true, and more importantly actually, the fact that a bunch of people retweet it and a bunch of people like it. So at that stage, it is more like the public aspect which creates trust, which creates truth. But we are pushing up that boundary constantly. You probably have seen those videos where you take text and then you take a face, let's say President Obama's face, and then you have his face move as if he was saying that text. You know, I hope that is still true for Trump, that he's not really saying those things or tweeting those things. But so it is very interesting how our trust in things gets constantly challenged and we constantly have to invent new things. Long story short, I worry about whether I will get my Estonian card here after all these pictures. And about this one, I don't want to say very much, but the second part of my talk is about the value of data. So Jeff Bezos hired me as his chief scientist. You know, it's like when Angela Merkel called me, it was kind of weird. Somebody says Merkel, and I say, Weigand am Apparat. And so same was true for Jeff Bezos. He just called me and asked me whether I would like to come up to Seattle and become his chief scientist. Not that he had a scientist, so it was easy to be the chief scientist for the first one. It turns out that Jeff really believes in experiments. So often get asked the question, what really is the reason for the success of Amazon? And my very honest opinion is the scientific method. So everything you see on the website is done through thousands of experiments. We often had arguments where one person thought one thing, the other person thought the other thing. And as long as we can, you know, write those hypotheses down and decide on how do we do the test, if you have a few hundred million customers, you get the answer to any question you have within minutes. So that cycle time, which in traditional marketing, as some of you are in, that cycle time of months gets down to a cycle time of minutes. So the time scale of innovation, because of that power of the internet, of being connected, that time scale of innovation has really shrunk down to almost nothing. That, in my opinion, is the driver behind Amazon's success. And I did my undergrad thesis at CERN in Geneva, where I studied bubble chambers. And these are just particles that you have interact with each other. And the last time I did an experiment on identity was in the Bosch cafeteria. And I took a tray, and I put different things on the tray because I thought about the poor people having to wash the trays. And then immediately when I got to the cash register, she flagged that I was not honest. I said, what did I do wrong? I'm not sure if you know this, but the tray has embedded an RFID chip. So you can't take the tray from the salad bar and use it for the meat, because not the cameras recognize what's on the tray, but because of that embedded chip inside the tray. I thought that's very interesting. Just like these particles in physics, the cafeteria at Schillerhöhe. Yeah. So for me, scientific method means one thing. It means being curious. Now, we have heard about Estonia doing extremely well in the PISA studies in education. I spent a significant time of my last 17 years, 7 months every year, in China. I had a house in Shanghai, which I'm just selling, and it is striking that Chinese so focus on answering questions. Now here, this day and age with Google, anybody can find an answer. Whether it's correct or not is a different question. But the skill we have to hone in is how to ask good questions. And what is a good question? A good question is a question which has some trade-off in the answer. Not black or white, not yes or no, but where you understand some about the dimensions of the underlying space. So for me, it's not about invented for life. It is about inventing for life. It is continuing to ask good questions. That for me is a corollary of doing experiments at Amazon. All right, so the talk is called Data for the People. You know, in the US Constitution, it is data of the people, by the people, for the people. So let's pause for a moment and think about that of. Data of the people. Here's an example from Bosch. Parking. So there is cars that have cameras in them, and as they merrily drive around, they look at the side of the street whether there are parking spots. In other words, whether there is no car where normally there is a car. That means if there's a driveway, of course, there normally is no car, so it doesn't register it. But if there's an open parking spot, they report to the parking authority headquarters, parking data headquarters. I think I saw a spot there. So that's a very interesting way of collecting data, basically of the people, by having cameras just observe things. I was in Shanghai last Monday, and I learned that the 50,000 taxi cabs that drive around in Shanghai now all have, by the police, have cameras in their basic rear view mirrors built in. And what these cameras do is the cameras look around what's going on. So it's no longer just those few traffic cameras above the traffic light, but it can be anywhere. Any taxi now is acting as a sensor, as a camera for the government. And apparently it is legal to issue a traffic citation just based on what those cameras report. Two more examples. One from the bathroom. So I needed to go to the bathroom, and as I was about to sit down, I see a camera staring at me. And I thought, what is that? And then I inquired. A friend of mine writes a software for it. He said, oh, Andreas, the purpose of these cameras is to reduce the amount of toilet paper people steal. So you can only get 30 centimeters every 7 minutes. Now, call me paranoid. This morning, I had breakfast at the Telegraph Hotel, and I have a video of that. I'm not sure whether anybody else is staying at the Telegraph Hotel. I think the two ladies next to me, you looked at the app, so I concluded from this, you also were coming to this conference. And I looked under the food containers, and there were, what, can you guess what? Two cameras, look at me. So that's just crazy. I did not want any sort of irritation with the hotel. I didn't bring it up with them. But I did a video and I'm curious, why do they have under the food where people get their breakfast, well hidden, two cameras looking not anywhere, but looking at me. So maybe the last example is a California company called Vigilant Solutions. And all they do is they look at license plates. So they look at your car number sign. So all they do, OCR, optical character recognition on license plates. So that you think is quite innocent. You know, it's not data of the people, is it? It's data of the cars. But then you think about it. And, you know, that guy who called his wife like at 6:30 in the evening and said, "Honey, you know, work is so hard. I'm sorry, I'm coming home late again tonight." And she said, "Well, I've already checked with Digital Solutions. You already left the office half an hour ago, and I know where your car is now." You know, it is also data of the people, basically, that you can just put together. Now, these are new questions we have. Of course, just like in the Stasi, it would be possible to write down manually license plates of all the cars coming by. But that can't be possibly illegal, right? I mean, nobody can stop you from writing down a license plate. On the other hand, if you now connect all of this data, then suddenly you pretty much have a good idea of the patterns of movement of your entire population. I gave a talk in Holland 3 months ago in Maastricht, and they told me that you can get tickets, speeding tickets issued, just by the fact that if you are seen in one town at a certain point in time, and then seeing at another town, 100 kilometers away, maybe Holland is not that big, 10 kilometers away, in a certain minute, then from that they can conclude that you must have been speeding. So that is all very scary to me. And so my book starts with a saying where everything is recorded. And it's not so much the recording, but the saving, which I'm really exploring how the changes of, you know, who we are. Are we what we share? Or are we or what we do not share? All right, but this is some example data of the data. Then many of the data are data by the people. So one of the sayings I often have, and I'm very curious about this, I say, what the KGB wouldn't have gotten out of people under torture, now people knowingly and willingly share with the world on Facebook. There is a KGB museum here, and I go there at 2:30 today. So if anybody is also as curious as I am, what machines of surveillance they had, I think this here in Tallinn is the place to check it out. And there are, of course, phone calls as data by the people. So I've heard the story that there was a German who had a very good business idea. He thought he would sell apartments, condominiums, that not only weren't built yet, but were never going to be built. And he took people's down payments, and then, you know, once he had a few million in the bank, he just left the country. And he was not stupid. I mean, of course, he left his mobile phone here. I mean, he wouldn't have wanted to be tracked in whichever country he went to by his mobile phone. A few weeks later, he was woken up in the morning by a hard knock at his door at a little hut in Canada. Interpol had found him. How would you think is that possible? So we are the data we create. And in marketing, you know that people are characterized by the attributes they have. But we also are characterized by the connections we have. So that gentleman from Germany, of course, had a few friends he was going to call with his new SIM card, the Canadian SIM card. And Interpol had a good social graph analysis. And they realized that clearly, as he left the country, that node had dropped out, but then there was another node that seemed to make phone calls to similar people. Then, of course, it's easy to track down where a mobile phone is, and that is logically necessary. If you're talking on the phone, you have to be connected to some network, and it was very easy for them to find him in that new short-lived home in Canada. And for what I know, is in prison in Germany and probably thinking, what else he could have done. So those are examples of data of the people and by the people. And now, what are we collecting these data for? Of course, data for the marketers. That is the purpose, right? Or maybe not. Maybe we want to have it as just data for the people. And what does that mean? Here's my second part of the talk. What is the value of data? So we talked a lot about data. I scared you with some examples. Now let's talk about the value of data. Any idea what's the value of data? I have a very simple answer, and I bet that you will not forget it. The value of data is the impact data has on a decision. So in lots of these conversations about, gee, should Google pay me for me using Google, or Facebook that I'm using Facebook, etc., taking a deep breath and asking the question, how does the data help whom with what decision? So for me, the value of Google is way more than the couple of bucks they could pay me. It is helping me with my decisions. So if you think about this, then in most cases, if you look at back in history, it is not about collecting data, but it's about connecting data, where the value is coming from. Here's a brief history of the last 50 years. In the 70s, we built computers. In the 80s, we connected computers. That's actually when I did my undergrad at CERN in Geneva, and being connected to DAISY in Hamburg and my university in Bonn was just amazing. Then I went to Stanford for my PhD, and who of you has heard about neural networks? Okay, most people. Who of you had heard about, from you, had heard about neural networks 30 years ago? Yes. Actually, I did my PhD in neural networks, and the first example we were given, and I just proudly want to share this with you, first example we were giving was Bosch, where Bosch used neural nets in the late 80s by listening to windshield wipers to figure out whether they are likely to be correct or whether they might be broken. So that's one of these wonderful early examples where Bosch really was super early in playing with things and trying out things, namely learning from data. So that was the connecting computers. Then in the 90s, we moved up from connecting computers to getting value from data from connecting pages. That is where the roots of Google are. Because Google looked at the page link structure to figure out what link of the many possible links they could show you, what page might be the most relevant for you, what might be a good page. And for that, they computed this thing called PageRank, which is based on the connection of pages. Then the 2000s, and some of you might remember that company in Espoo, not too far away, connecting people was Nokia's slogan. But of course, Facebook is the main company which has gone away here in the West of connecting people, and in China, of course, it's WeChat. I actually want to share a story with you here from China. It is always fascinating for me when I move back for a couple of weeks or months from the US to Shanghai. We are so used to the assumptions which are baked into our communication system that every time I cross one way, and when I come back, it takes me several days to realize how to do things. For example, when I was just in China last week, when I come back to the US, I feel sort of intruded in my privacy that Facebook shows a friend of mine who might have sent me a message that I've read the message. I mean, that is just so weird that he knows I can't just plausible deniability say, oh no, I haven't seen that message. Sorry, I missed you at that party. No, Facebook says read or seen, or same for WhatsApp. So the Chinese person would say, wow, that is so personal. Or my social graph, key to decide whether I'm going to accept somebody as a Facebook friend is who are the friends in common? How else would I accept? How else would I know whether to accept or not accept a friend request? Again, the Chinese would say, wow, that's such a personal thing. My circle of friends, why would anybody share that? Why would a paradigm of a communication platform be built such they actually share who my friends are, or at least the friends in common with somebody else? So I think it's the most interesting experiment which we are running in mankind right now. 1 billion people on one set of values, American values, or Facebook's values, which is not exactly the same, and 1 billion people on WeChat's values, and seeing how this massive experiment is evolving in the next 2 years. Very curious here. So it's about connecting. So we had connecting computers, connecting pages, then connecting people. Now, I think we then move to connecting data. And then the Chinese always think, I write it this way when I say connecting sensors. But what I, of course, and what I mean here for you, Bosch, is connecting sensors with an S and not with a C at the beginning, or Internet of Things, or however you want to call it. So, long story short, it's an incredible amount of data that's being produced. Now, to the third part of my talk, what about the people? So I did my thesis on machine learning, and I've seen many things in AI in those 30 years. And in my perspective, the most important thing is that we are clear what is it that we are trying to optimize. What is it that we are trying to have as our objective function? What are we driving towards? I think one of the key problems which we have in Silicon Valley right now is that the objective function of Facebook is not aligned with the objective function of its users. And what we see is that this needs to be harmonized in some way. And that means Facebook needs to learn of how to actually respect the users. That, in my opinion, is not the case. And the fact that, as I've heard, some people believe that Mark Zuckerberg lied under oath, both in the US and in Europe when he testified. For this, we have precedences that if people perjury, lie under oath, they go to prison. So I think this is a very serious issue that we really need to be very transparent what the objective function is, and just arguing, I'll get back to you later, and then writing a 700-page pamphlet propaganda by the lawyers, which within a day, the Wall Street Journal showed the discrepancy of what's written there and what is said in Congress, is, I think, a very big problem. But Facebook aside, let's go back to Amazon. So in Amazon, I worked on recommendations. And I always say, making recommendations is easy. I mean, anybody can recommend anything. Evaluating recommendations is hard. If you think through that, then what you realize is, what is actually our role of people, as people going forward? So when I was in Germany a few years ago, and I also just come from China, people asked me what advice I would give the Germans. And I said, learn Chinese. So you can at least be a tour guide when they come and they want to see the river and the castle and the lake. So of course, last week I was in China, and they said, and what advice would you give the Chinese? And I thought, learn to code, because that way you can at least help the robots when they come, like the Germans are trying to help the Chinese when they come. And here's an Amazon patent from early this year, which is a perfect example from us learning to help robots. That is a wristband which the workers wear in the warehouse. That wristband tells the worker whether to work right or left or far or close, etc. So it's basically one way of communication haptically, communicating haptically with a worker. Let's completely leave the surveillance aspects at the side here. I mean, this is an amazing way of just controlling every worker microscopically, every step he or she takes. But that is not our discussion right now. What is the purpose of those? Is it really just to help the workers? No. It is to collect data for the robots, so the robots can really replace the workers. That is the purpose of that Amazon patent. So, in many cases, I think our role in the future will be to help the robots do their job better. I don't have much to say to this topic beyond that, but want now to move to the third topic of my talk, which is what rights should we have as people towards the data we create? And this is for us as customers, for us as citizens, for us as individuals in this post-privacy economy. And that's important for me. Post-privacy, I think we should not fool ourselves. We should not fall to that illusion that there actually is any privacy left. It is an economy. So we should have our rights. We should actually get compensated in the right way for that. So I really view that the perspective to take is not, please, let's have someone give our privacy back. It's not possible. That is not possible. But what we should do is, what are the rights, the principles which should stand up against organizations, governments, against companies? And I divide those rights into two groups. The first group are so-called transparency rights, rights to see. GDPR is doing a pretty good job in helping us actually getting these rights realized. My book came out last year, so it was sort of at the same time as GDPR was developed, and the right to access your data, to see your data, is a very good right. By the way, I think the most important part of GDPR was it got 1 billion people to think about their data. So for me, no educational experiment could have gotten 1 billion people to think about the data they create and share. Then sending billions and billions of emails to people saying, please click here so we can continue to spam you. So I think that is, for me, the most important thing about GDPR, that it got people to be a little bit more critical about the data they produce. The second transparency right is the right to inspect the refineries. And I have a few examples here. It's like when you buy a Bosch Haushaltsgerät, you know, and they have a security seal on it, and they tell you how energy efficient it is, and so on and so forth. So that is my second set of transparency rights. And then we have some rights where we actually do things with the data. A right to amend. We should all be able to amend any piece of data we have, not to change it, but very much what we have in Estonia with all the blockchain ideas is anybody can write to it and the history will be preserved. The right to blur. That's one which I really love as a physicist, that I determine the radius, the granularity, the precision with which my data is allowed to be processed. So I can tell here as I enter, I only want my geolocation to be processed within, say, 1 kilometer. Good. But now, when I get some Domino's pizza delivered, that poor dear pizza delivery boy, he doesn't know where to drop the pizza in that 1 kilometer. So part of data literacy or digital literacy is that people understand where they need to give data in order to get value back. And also where they don't need to give data, where just marketeers try to squeeze some data out of them where there's no logical connection to what they actually need. The third one is the right to experiment. So I talked about this in the context of Amazon. We should have a seat at the controls, at the control room. We should be able to set knobs, and to build mental models based on different settings. Example, one of the fundamental trade-offs in machine learning is the so-called exploration-exploitation trade-off. Exploration means you try out new things. Exploitation means you do what you know works okay again and again and yet again. And this trade-off is not something which can be set by first principles, but in a given point in time, you might say when you get music recommendations, today I really feel about really exploring totally new things, things I might hate or things I might just be amazed about what they are. Another situation, you might move it over to the exploitation. Just give me what I know so I can just relax on that flight or something like that. So this is an example where people should be given these knobs. You as marketeers should give people knobs to play with. And by the way, you of course learn from them how they set those knobs if you give them these knobs. So don't try to guess what people want if you can give them the possibility to actually play themselves. And the last of these agency rights is the right to port data. In many cases now, it's a mix between blockchain, which keeps the history intact, and encryption, which is the right way to look at the right to port. For instance, a company in Shanghai called carblock.io, which puts the car data on the blockchain, but gives you a key. So only those people who you give permission to unlock certain parts of the car data have access to those data. So it's a bit quick how I talk about this, but there are technological solutions which I think will change some of the fears we have about our data. For instance, that an insurance company would access our data and give us bad rates or potentially even deny us coverage. Okay. So, the future. Is it a dystopia where we worry? I gave you the example of insurance companies, health insurance, saying, well, you know, we know something about you which you don't know. Even mortgage. Let's say you're likely to get Parkinson's. Oh no, Alzheimer's is the one where you forget things, right? There are three good things about Alzheimer's. You meet new people every day. You can hide your own Easter eggs. And you meet new people every day. I didn't want to make this job. Is it a dystopia where it will be terrible that you don't get that mortgage because the company knows that you will not live that long to pay off the mortgage of 30 years? Or is it a utopia where Amazon already knows what you want before you even want it? So in Delphi, at the Oracle, they have had the know yourself, erkenne dich selbst. I don't speak Greek, but you know, German is probably good enough. So now computers can help us with the data we create to recognize ourselves, to learn things about ourselves. What do we do about that? I think, you know, it is, as Jeff Bezos would say, day one on that. But one thing is clear, we can't just leave it up to them. For me, digital literacy, and that's, you know, why I'm working with Angela Merkel on that, digital literacy is helping people make decisions in an informed way. Just as we learned about in German, Tierkunde, Pflanzenkunde, Erdkunde, we should learn about Datenkunde. As we had a science about animals and geography and so on, we should have a digital literacy as an important part of what we actually need to learn in middle school, in high school. Big question still remains. Where is this balance of power going? Is this balance of power shifting that the individuals are better off? It seemed that way a few years ago. For instance, reviews. Amazon having been absolutely radical in saying, we don't want to tell people illusions about the products. We want to let anybody write to the website what they think about a product. I think every one of us is using reviews to make purchasing decisions. So it seems that the balance of power is shifting towards the individuals. But when it comes to government, for instance, particularly if I think about China, I think we don't have a chance as individuals. I have many stories, and I know we have a coffee break afterwards that I'm very happy to tell you in private where. I mean, here's an example. You all talk about big data. Here's an example of really small data. The hotel room locks in China are conveniently all centrally supplied by the police. So just that information of knowing how often or when a door opens at night, immediately, very small data, draws the attention to subjects they want to make sure that they actually are right. You know, maybe the door opened a few times and who knows what the problem is, but somebody might be just swinging by and just checking in with them. So that's an example of small data. So that was the perspective on data symmetry and transparency. By the way, in Sweden, I've heard, maybe in other Nordic countries, that I can see, if I was a Swedish citizen, any other Swedish citizen's tax return. Is that true? Yes. And what I've learned is amazing, that he will also know that I asked for his tax return. And that element I love about it. That data symmetry is just really great. Yes, but not that somebody can just look at all of them without people knowing that they look at them. It's not the NSA. Last part of the talk, data rules. So I now take the perspective of companies. You're all at Bosch. Bosch is an amazing company. You have an amazing set of data. And I very briefly want to give you the key four rules which I think are important. It's based on my experience work at Amazon as well with a bunch of amazing companies in the world. One, start with a question, not with the data. I know there are all these consultants who tell you that, you know, trust us, you know, you sit on all this data. If you just buy our services like McDonald's or McKinsey, what's it called? McKinsey, right? If you just buy our services, then, you know, we'll give you all these insights and wisdom. Bullshit. Get clear what your question is. So if you don't have a question, then any euro spent on data analysis is wasted. Two, focus on decisions and actions. That's a very important one. I told you about the driver between Amazon being experiments. And experiments at the very beginning have, in the simplest case, an A-B test, two different actions. And then you evaluate which one you like better. For that, the intelligence goes into having good evaluation function. But start with what you actually can do and not with what insights you can get. Three, embrace transparency, both within the organization and externally. I already gave you the external example, which was allowing reviews to be put up on the page, which today is no big deal for anybody. Here's a thought experiment, which I invented when I was at Amazon. And I'm a physicist, so we are allowed to have thought experiments, which means you actually don't have to do the experiment. You just think about doing the experiment. Here's a thought experiment. Right now, and I'm sure that applies at Bosch as well, most of you need to go to their bosses to ask for permission when they went to share data. So if you want to share some data which might be considered confidential, you need to get your boss, and maybe even your boss's boss, to sign off on that. Here's a thought experiment. You need to go to your boss if you do not want to share the data. And think how that is slowly changing your mind of saying, yeah, that would be interesting, because then the others, of course, also would need to go to their bosses. So now we suddenly would see all the data in the company. And what could we do with that? So today is not enough time to really go into detail into those experiments. But tomorrow in the workshop, I will, with a friend of mine, Gam Dias, who is coming in from Spain in the afternoon today, I will walk you through some of these experiments. Now, the fourth rule is respect and empower your customers. I know you come from marketing, and I know that many of you might sort of reject that kind of, because you know what you put in those brochures. But I just invite you to think about, you know, what if it was an entirely transparent world? And what if your goal really was to empower your customers, to do the right thing for them, not for you? So this are not questions about the data set. They are not questions about the tool set. They are questions about the skill set even. These are questions about the mindset. So for me, digital literacy is a mindset question. And I invite any one of you to talk to me today, tomorrow, to come to the workshop and let me know what you think, let me know where you think I'm wrong. You learn much more from your mistakes than from what you write. And I sometimes don't know about the future. Whether do I know where I want to be, but I don't know how to get there? Or do I not even know where I want to be? But maybe I end with a prayer. Reinhold Niebuhr's Serenity Prayer. That is my attitude towards AI. You know, people and AI. So, Lord, give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you very much.